It was said of Robert E. Lee in his youth that he was good at finishing up. He had a reputation, even in his teenage years, of bringing to completion tasks begun. Brethren, it is my prayer this morning that we would follow in the way and that we would leave this conference with a clear conscience that we also were good at finishing up in our respective task of proclamation and hearing. I want to say this morning, thank you for your attentiveness. Thank you for your receptivity to what has been preached. I can say from the heart it has been my benefit, a benefit to my soul, to prepare these messages, and it has been my privilege to deliver them to you. And I want to say in a special way to my brethren in the ministry, no one is more conscious of your superior abilities relative to me than the one standing here now. And I thank you for your respect. I thank you for your encouragement, for your humility, for your teachable spirit. And I want to remind you that in earlier years, I doubted, and I began to doubt seriously, that there were men in the earth like the men of God who are in this place this week. And it has been a strength to my soul in the task of reformation to recall your names and your churches. And I can say with a clear conscience with other brethren here from our own assembly that often, Wednesday night and Saturday morning, your names are called and the names of your churches are called. And again, it has been a strength to our souls. I thank you, colleagues in the ministry, for the grace and the courtesy that you have consistently demonstrated to me this week. Now, many of you have come this week and asked something of a bibliography relative to Robert E. Lee. I must say I cannot spare too many minutes at this point, but let me briefly cite a few of the more helpful sources. And I would begin with a work by Robert E. Lee, Jr., the general's youngest son, simply entitled Recollections and Letters of R. E. Lee. Thankfully, it is back in print after many years of being out of print, and it can be readily found in most general bookstores or certainly ordered. It is a book that gives a very intimate look at this man, very little of the military in it, much more of the domestic side of General Lee's life. And then there is another early biography by J. William Jones, and it is in print through Sprinkle Publications, The Life and Letters of General Lee. It is a very helpful source because of the amount of primary material that it draws from, and also because of the author's close association with Lee for many years and with Mrs. Lee. And then there is a work by Henry Alexander White, who also authored the book Southern Presbyterian Leaders. Henry Alexander White was a fine man of God, a professor at Washington College while General Lee was president, and he wrote a book entitled R.E. Lee and the Southern Confederacy. But the final word, perhaps, on the life of General Robert E. Lee was written by Douglas Southall Freeman, the Pulitzer Prize work consisting of four massive volumes, and for scholarship and objectivity, nothing surpasses those four volumes. As to children's literature, I would recommend two works, one by Harding Carter, R.E. Lee and the Road to Honor. It is out of print. It can be found in the old Landmark series of children's books that were authored largely in the 50s. It can be readily found if you would rummage around through old bookshops or go to library sales, as they commonly throw out these landmark books that had a decided character orientation in their treatment of men. And then there is a biography by Mary L. Williamson, The Life of Robert E. Lee. She also authored The Life of Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart. And this woman wrote with an eye to character and quite clearly with a spiritual mindset. Those three biographies, including the one on Lee, are out of print, but there is a publisher at the moment considering putting all three in one binding and issuing them again. I trust that might come to reality. They are some of the better sources. There are all kinds of dime store kinds of books written to simply sell books and make money, and they do not deserve our attention. We have now considered the primary, the fundamental, and the comprehensive virtue of manhood that I am convinced is the virtue of courage. Yesterday, we began looking at man as a husband, as a man of God. And I noted that the manly trait that characterizes a man before his God is that of dutiful obedience. We take up now this morning looking at a man as a husband. And it is my own understanding of the scripture that manliness is demonstrated in this role as a husband in three distinct yet interrelated ways. In the first place, a true man is an active and wise leader of his wife. Ephesians 5:23, the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church. As the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Distinctive masculinity is exhibited in a man's thoughtful and demonstrative headship relative to his wife over against the contemptible and the contemporary image of the couch potato husband absorbed in his own shriveled world of job, TV, newspaper, and snack food. It is a biblical portrayal of a man out front setting the pace, giving definitive direction spiritually, educationally, socially, financially, laying down the tracks of life upon which wife and children follow. A true man is an active and a wise leader of his wife and family. But secondly, a true man is one who demonstratively loves his wife. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Again at verse 28, husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. Colossians 3:19, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Manliness is characterized in the role of husband by a caring, giving, self-sacrificing, expending love which has as its focus the highest welfare of a wife. Contrary to the patterns of wanting and expecting and demanding which are embedded in most males, a true man lovingly serves and leads a wife, expending himself for her good. And I would take this opportunity to direct your attention to chapter 2, men, of B.M. Palmer's book, The Family. Again, in my limited experience, I have come across no finer treatment of the kind of sacrificial, caring, expending love that a man is to give to his wife than what Palmer writes of in chapter 2. And men are in our assembly here this morning can testify that we have gathered in circles one with another and read that chapter out loud and then bowed and prayed page by page through it. Thirdly, not only is a true man one who leads his wife and then loves his wife, but a true man is one who understands his wife. 1 Peter 3:7. You husbands likewise love your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman. The phrase "an understanding way" is descriptive of a man's manner of life with his mate, wherein he studiously gives himself to the task of perceiving her rather unique needs and then applies himself to the skillful fulfillment of those womanly needs. To live with a wife in an understanding way is to dwell with her guided by a correct assessment of her femininity, of her roles and her duties, over against your roles and duties. It speaks of a manner of living characterized by sensitivity, by close consideration of her womanhood, the needs and the desires that properly emanate from it. It speaks of living with a woman, understanding men that sometimes they need to be able to cry without giving to you an explanation why. Living with your wives in an understanding way is demonstrated when a man has come to grips with his wife's need for the praise of her husband, for gratitude, for intimate, undistracted communication. He comes to grips with her need that once in a while the husband would enter into her practical labors, table and dirty dishes. A man who lives with his wife in an understanding way comes to grips with and is patient in the course of that time when the manner of woman is upon her. True Christian manhood is displayed in a husband who provides a wise and comprehensive leadership for his wife, who selflessly loves her, giving to her that which will enhance her good, who sensitively, perceptively assesses her nature and needs and responds accordingly. Now, when one studies the life of General Robert E. Lee and keeps in view his domestic life, one reality soon arises. And it's that as a military officer, there were prolonged periods of separation between General Lee and his family. Of Lee's 39 years of marriage, 30 of them were lived while he served in the U.S. Army, 4 of them in the Confederate States Army. And thus much that we glean about his relationship to Mrs. Lee must be found in his correspondence. And if you read that correspondence, you will come across repeatedly the most unreserved expressions of tender love, concern for her health, the yielding of practical advice on a host of matters, directions relative to the children, there is revealed a constant, thoughtful tenderness. And I want to read but one of the letters that reveals such things. October 26, 1862. He's received death, or a letter about the death of his daughter Annie, who thankfully was gloriously converted a few years earlier, further in Stanton, Virginia. And he says now to his wife, and he's come back from Sharpsburg. And if you know anything about Sharpsburg and that baptism of blood, it would be something almost impossible for a man to gather up these kinds of emotions in light of what occurred at Sharpsburg. He says to his wife, "I cannot express the anguish I feel at the death of our sweet Annie. To know that I shall never see her again on earth, that her place in our circle, which I'd always hoped one day to enjoy, is forever vacant, is agonizing in the extreme. But God in this, as in all things, has mingled mercy with the blow, in selecting that one best prepared to leave us. May you be able to join me in saying, 'His will be done.' I know how much you will grieve, how much she will be mourned. I wish I could give you any comfort, but beyond our hope in the great mercy of God and the belief that He takes her at the time and place when it is best for her to go, there is none. May that same mercy be extended to us all, and may we be prepared for His summons." That's of the character of the correspondence you read from a man like Lee. J. William Jones says, rightly, "It will not do to follow to their homes or trace the domestic lives of many of the world's heroes. They shine before the public gaze, but are very unlovely in their domestic relations, but not so with this man. Those virtues which were so admired by the public were all the more conspicuous in the family circle." And then Jones writes, "It was my privilege to see much of his domestic life in Lexington, to have been the frequent inmate of his model home. And I may say that if one wanted to paint a model husband and father, he would search the world in vain for a brighter example. Whether with affectionate playfulness, teasing his daughters, tenderly wheeling Mrs. Lee, who had become a confirmed invalid, or entertaining his visitors with that courtesy and grace which seemed inseparable from the man, he always won your admiration and made you feel that he was the very embodiment of all the virtues of domestic life." The leadership of General Lee that he provided his wife and family was first and foremost demonstrated in the fixed habit of conducting family worship. Robert E. Lee, Jr., writing in the book I've earlier cited, says this, and I quote, "My father was proud of his daughter-in-law and much gratified at his son's marriage. He was delighted with the manner in which she, the daughter-in-law, adapted herself to the ways of all her new relations, with her sweet attention to my mother, and above all, with her punctuality. She had been warned beforehand by her husband," and the husband is an older son of Lee, "that to please his father, she must always be ready for family prayers, which were read by him every morning just before breakfast. This she succeeded in doing, never failing once to be on time. She said afterward that she did not believe that General Lee would have an entirely high opinion of any person, even George Washington, if he were not ready for family prayers." I read another observation by the pastor at that time of the Second Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, Pastor W.T. Brantley, who stayed for some time in Lee's home. He says, and I quote, "When a guest at his house, the first thing with which he greeted me on coming down in the morning was the Bible, with a request that I should lead the devotions of the family. And when, after reading God's Word, we knelt down together, his prompt and cordial responses attested the earnestness with which he adopted the petitions addressed to the throne of grace." Much could be said about Lee's prayer life while he led the Army of Northern Virginia. It is said by those who knew him, his staff officers, that he maintained regular hours of secret devotion, which he allowed nothing else, however pressing, to interrupt. In camp, on the march, in private life, it was his fixed habit to know secret prayer, and quite apparently, family devotions. General Lee's love and understanding, his tenderness, his perception of Mrs. Lee's needs, were tested in a crucible that many of us know nothing of. For Mrs. Lee was in failing health and was confined for a number of years, the last 13 years of their marriage, to a wheelchair. And faithfully the general waited upon her needs, wheeled her and looked to her interest. In the only full-length detailed biography of Mrs. Lee, the author writes, "She, Mrs. Lee, found great happiness in being with her husband in their own home. It was the evenings especially to which she looked forward, for she was happy in the company of her husband." And then, now quoting Mrs. Lee, "who spends his evenings at home instead of frequenting the card parties that attract so many," unquote. Then the author describes seated before the open fire, Mrs. Lee would sew, while by the light of the lamp her husband would read to her. The evening always ended with a chapter from the Bible followed by prayer. The young couple carried out a tradition of both of their families and started a custom that followed through all of their lives. Mrs. Lee writes, early on in their marriage, when they were assigned to Fortress Monroe in Virginia, and she was often a bit homesick for the family homestead in Arlington, she says, "I ought not to complain of what I have not, when I have so many comforts, and especially that of a tender and affectionate husband." And that tenderness and that affection, by all evidences, grew stronger and stronger. And that love and understanding were illustrated during Lee's years as president of Washington College, when the general would wheel Mrs. Lee about in her chair. And now I pick up another quote. "And the students, knowing the hour," that is the hour when the general would come home from the office and take his wife upon her regular trip or her wheeling about, "the students, knowing the hour, would walk slowly by the house, hoping to catch a glimpse of their hero rolling his wife in her wheelchair, stooping at times to see if she were comfortable, and occasionally leaning over to pat her on the cheek." Brethren, that's manliness as a husband. Conducting family worship daily. What measure of embarrassment and shame would be evoked this morning if we polled each man on that issue? And men, your excuses would pale in the burning light of Lee's example, because I believe it a safe assumption, no man here is more busy than General Robert E. Lee was in his full career. And yet, by all evidence, it was the fixed custom of his life to begin the day with family worship and to end it. What if we polled Reformed Baptist men with their heads full of orthodoxy? Would you measure up to the soldier? Conducting family worship daily, evenings at home with his wife, reading the Bible aloud, a tender and affectionate husband, nursing her in her illness. My friend, this is the same man who, in the midst of the bloody slaughter at Fredericksburg, when his troops poured out their lethal fire upon wave after wave of gallant Federals seeking to obey the orders of their armchair general, said this: "It is well that war is so terrible. We should grow too fond of it." This is the same man who, between early May and early June of 1864, inflicted on Grant's Army of the Potomac between 55 and 60,000 casualties, a total equal to 8 years in Vietnam, in 1 month with single-fire muskets, a number equal to the entire number of his own army. And in 20 minutes at Cold Harbor, killed 7,000 Union troops. It's that man who patted the cheek of his invalid wife and read the Bible and prayed and was called by her own lips a tender and affectionate husband. Men, could your wives honestly say this morning that I have so many comforts, and especially that of a tender and affectionate husband? Or would they say, I have so many sorrows, especially that of a cold, silent, self-seeking, distant, preoccupied, passive husband? In the words of Paul in Colossians, a man embittered against me. Men, if you're living according to the profile of distinctive manhood, your wife, as Lee's wife, says the former. But then what about Lee as a father? What about, more importantly, a man as a father? Now, in my notes, where I was going to start and then spend most of my time was Ephesians 6:4. But there has been an older gentleman here who has, for four previous nights, not only stolen my thunder, but the clouds which give rise to the thunder, and has sucked all of the moisture out of the atmosphere that give rise to the clouds. So what can I say? I would refer you to one other text, daring not to say a thing about Ephesians 6:4. In 1 Timothy 3 at verse 4, Paul writes of the elder, "He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity." Now, clearly, while this is a qualification for the eldership, who would deny that it is also a legitimate goal and standard for any true man as a father. A man as a father demonstrates authentic, biblically profiled manhood as an instructor and disciplinarian of his children, whose instruction and discipline are undergirded by a consistent example. I point out the word to you in 1 Timothy 3:4, the term dignity. He keeps his children under control with all dignity. The sense is this: a true man's fatherly teaching, his corrective discipline, is robed in the garments of a noble character. His excellence as a man, his high sense of propriety, there is a masculine dignity, and the sense of the word is that it calls out from the child a certain measure of esteem and respect and obedience. The sense is the example of the man registers in the conscience of the child and that dignity of the father aids in the drawing out of mature and godly responses from a son. When I considered Robert E. Lee the father, my mind runs in illustration of this term dignity to a statement by his son. Men, listen carefully. From that early time, and this is Robert E. Lee, Jr. writing, I began to be impressed with my father's character as compared with other men. Everybody in our household respected, revered, and loved him. That seemed a matter of course. But then it began to dawn on me that everyone else with whom I was thrown held him in the same high regard. And then R. E. Lee, Jr. says, and consider this in light of the nurturing you've heard of these evenings. He was always bright and gay with us little folk, romping, playing, and joking with us. With the older children, he was just as congenial. And I have seen him join my brothers and their friends when they would try their prowess at a high jump over the bars and beat them. The younger children, he petted a great deal. Now, I can hardly resist one little anecdote to interrupt this quote. Preachers have various ways of receiving therapy after their preaching. One of mine has been to seek out wife, son, or daughter to rub and tickle my feet. Now, I do wait till I get home for this therapy. And for most of my ministry, it's been almost like the draft. I've had to conscript a member of the family to provide this therapy to my feet until one day I read about the general who had this same idiosyncrasy. And I read this account of how he would come home and take his shoes off, and his children would gather and rub and tickle his feet. And now when I come home after the Lord's Day services, it's no more conscription. It's a matter of choosing. Now, who is going to tickle Dad's feet today? Returning to the quote, the younger children he petted a great deal. Our greatest treat was to get into his bed in the mornings and listen to him talk in his bright, entertaining way. This custom was kept up until I was at least 10 years old. But now a transition. Although he was so companionable, joyous, and unreserved with us, he was very firm on all proper occasions, never indulged us in anything that was not good for us, and exacted the most implicit obedience. I always knew that it was impossible to disobey my father. I felt it in me. I never thought why, but was perfectly sure when he gave an order that it had to be obeyed. Exact obedience to every mandate of my father's was simply part of my life and being. Now why? Because of the dignity that had registered in the mind and conscience of a young son. Lee, as a father, was all man. He was instructor. He taught his sons, quote, to keep the commandments and walk in the same all the days of your life, unquote. He taught them math. He taught them Latin. Later in his life, as his sons were on their own, he taught them how to plant their crops. He gave them their marriage counseling. He was their friend, their playmate, their confidant, whose exemplary manhood had put a hook in their consciences. I might add here that General Lee was known for his great love for children. Extensive sections of his major biographies are given to this subject alone. His major biographies clearly state that a profile of his character is not complete without setting forth his marked fondness for children and the manner in which he seemed to draw them to himself, and time will not permit the unusual examples that illustrate indeed this thing. Episodes abound which describe his interest in children, his giving to them of his demanded time in some of the most improbable circumstances. I think it's safe to say General Robert E. Lee was an Ephesian father, a nurturing and chastening father whose precepts and rod were administered in the context of love and time invested in the interest and in the activities of his children. Remember R.A. Lee Jr.'s earlier quote, "I always found in my dad a sympathetic helper." Dad, what about it? You profess to be a man? Does such manliness mark your dealings with your offspring? Or is it too busy, too tired, to this, to that, for romping and playing and getting your children into the bed, to talk with them, to go out and high jump with them? I must resist a further word about fitness and stamina and the role of Lee in cultivating it in his own life. Dad, are you a true man? Or simply of the male gender before your children? And then we must consider this morning, and only in broad strokes now, a true man as a man in the world. We've considered a man as a husband, as a father, as a man before God. What about a man in the world? What marks out authentic, biblically profiled manhood before the world? I set before you but one text that I believe captures the essence of manhood, lived out in the myriad of circumstances in the world at large. And it is Philippians 2, verses 14 through 16. Paul writes, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, the world, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life." Now, time will not permit the exposition of this verse, so I shall simplify its sense by saying that as a man in the world, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, that we can capture the essence of what Paul is writing by saying that a man is to be a Christian gentleman. He is to conduct himself in a manner as to give no cause for offense and as to render a winsome testimony for the light of the gospel. We're speaking here of social relations. And we're speaking of a man of sensitivity, of propriety, of grace, a man conscious of others, conscious of his relations with others for their good, a consciousness of their needs, a man above reproach in his dealings with a perverse and crooked world. If you go to any reliable dictionary and look up the term gentleman, you'll find a definition, something on this order. A gentleman is a man whose conduct conforms to a high standard of propriety, whose conduct is marked by courtesy, proper manners, and due regard for others. I believe that comes close to capturing the essence of what Paul writes. Above reproach in the midst of this perverse and crooked generation. Listen as I quote. It's really only one aspect of the sense of Philippians 2, 14 to 16, but it does get at the heart of what it means to be a gentleman. It's Robert E. Lee's definition of a gentleman. He says, and I quote, "The forbearing use of power does not only form a touchstone, but the manner in which an individual enjoys certain advantages over others, it is the test of a true gentleman. The power which the strong have over the weak, the magistrate over the citizen, the employer over the employed, the educated over the unlettered, the experienced over the confiding, even the clever over the silly. The forbearing and inoffensive use of all this power or authority, or a total abstinence from it when the case admits it, will show a gentleman in a plain light. The gentleman does not needlessly and unnecessarily remind an offender of a wrong he may have committed against him. He can not only forgive, he can forget. And he strives for that nobleness of self and mildness of character which imparts the sufficient strength to let the past be but the past. A true man of honor feels humbled himself when he cannot help but humbling others." Now, I do not offer that as the sum and substance of a Christian gentleman, but what is germane to what I'm talking about is this consciousness of others, the consciousness of what propriety demands in our dealings with other men. And I say that it is that consciousness of propriety, that due regard for others, which is of the essence of being above reproach as a man in the midst of this world. While Lee was president at Washington College, one student early in his enrollment came to the general and asked for a list of rules. And Lee responded, "We have but one rule here. It is every student must be a gentleman." One pastor wrote, "Lee was and is my beau ideal of the highest type of Christian gentleman." Another writes, "Among men noble as the noblest in the lofty dignity of a Christian gentleman." Not much of that around anymore. Sloppy, shoddy, insensitive, careless, dull men who do not care about anything but themselves. God give us Christian gentlemen. But then, brethren, quickly I draw your attention to a man of God in the local church. We considered Lee as a man, or a true man, as a man before his God, dutiful obedience. A man as a husband, loving, leading, understanding his wife. A man as a father. A man as a gentleman in the world, and now a man in the church. And I have sought to distill my understanding of the Scriptures as to a true man in the church with these few words: true manliness is demonstrated in the church, wherein a man asserts a forwardness rooted in his vested headship relative to the woman, but appropriate to and consistent with his gifts and graces. True manliness is demonstrated in the church, wherein a man asserts a forwardness rooted in his vested headship relative to the woman, but appropriate to and consistent with his gifts and his graces." Now, what does that mean practically? Well, for some it means they shall occupy the office of elder. Their gifts and their graces dictate such. For others it means they shall occupy the office of deacon. For all, it means that when the assembled church gathers for prayer, men arise and be men leading the people of God to the throne of grace. And to all, it means, in the light of 1 Corinthians 14, verses 34 and following, that they are a kind of prophet to their own wife, relative to the public ministry of the word in the assembly. Men stand in the church as those providing its directive. They set the tone and the course of a local church by example, by their universal attendance, by their submission to their elders, by their willing cooperation with their deacons, by their participation in public prayer, by the investment of their tithes and their offerings and their lives in ways consistent with their divine endowments, gifts, and graces. And how I thank God that the day is present when people enter our small assembly up in the backwaters of New York State and they will comment on the way out about this masculine air in the assembly. That's exactly how it ought to be. And they do not find oppressed women. They do not find downtrodden women. My friend, if I know anything about what's going on in Boston Lake and we're represented here, we have women who are women. And they rejoice in a group of men who have taken seriously their manhood in a local church and have put shoe leather on it. May the same be said, and I trust it is true, in your own assemblies. What about Robert E. Lee? Consider the words of his pastor, his last pastor, William Nelson Pendleton, who writes in Personal Recollections of Lee, said Lee was a zealous, whole-souled churchman. Lee was known for his love for preachers. He wrote to his pastor just after the war. His pastor had served as an artillery general in the army. He says, "I am very glad that you have returned to the exercise of your sacred office, for there is no labor so beneficent, so elevated, so sublime as the teaching of salvation to erring sinners." And I could cite episode after episode wherein Lee lived out that kind of regard, that kind of 1 Thessalonians 5 regard for men in the ministry. Indeed, Lee's last public act before he was fatally stricken with a stroke was in the vestry meeting of his local church, of which he was a member of the vestry, to personally supply a substantial sum of money from his meager possessions. Lee lived the last part of his life nearly a pauper. But to supply himself a substantial sum of money to provide for a raise for his pastor. I might continue that account. Lee came home after that vestry meeting, and the last thing Lee was doing before he suffered the stroke was praying. He was seized as he prayed. He lingered some 12 days in and out of consciousness, but the last thing he did with a clear mind was to bow before his God. I might add at this point that Lee was also, in that time, the president of the Rock Bridge Bible Society. Now, don't read anything into that as to my view of that one way or another. It's for your information. The Rock Bridge Bible Society has as its one single aim the distribution of Bibles. It was very understandable then, in light of the fact that the Lincoln administration had declared Bibles contraband and would not allow them through the blockade, and in light of the wanton burning of Virginia homesteads, indeed, in those years of Reconstruction, Bibles were not common commodities. Lee was the president of that Bible society dedicated to distributing Bibles in his area. He was a lover of preaching that went to the heart. I quoted the other day a bit of what he said in response to a sermon by John A. Broadus. I want to go back and give you all that he said under a section that describes Lee's desire for practical preaching. He responded to Dr. Broadus this way. He said, "Sir, it was a noble sermon. One of the very best I ever heard. And the beauty of it was that you gave our young men the very marrow of the gospel and with a simple earnestness that must have reached their hearts and done them good." the evidence seems to make clear that not in perfection, but in the main, Lee was true man in the local church, a zealous, whole-souled churchman. I ask again, can the same be said of your masculinity? Were we to track your course Wednesday night, could it be said, a zealous, whole-souled churchman? What about your attitude to your elders? Could you from the heart write what Lee wrote about ministers of the gospel? Would you, if the chips were down and you a pauper, pull from your own pocket almost what amounted at that time to the widow's mite, so that your pastor, living on a meager salary himself, could have more? That's manhood, masculinity. God give us more zealous and whole-souled churchmen. Now, brethren, I know it's noon, and I'm going to draw this to a close. I had left a hole in my preparation, knowing that from message to message, things were going to be pushed over closer to that hole and begin to fall in. And I must say, truthfully, that the hole is full, and there's a mound upon it. I was, were the hole left vacant, going to speak to you now about some selected manly virtues, virtues that apply to male and female alike, but in our day, men seem destitute of. I would have liked to have had the time to have considered the matter of self-control and the related virtue of self-denial. I would have liked to have dealt with the virtue of humility. One anecdote. While Lee was president of Washington College, obviously having many guests stay with him in the president's house there, many of these guests had come from environments and situations at home where indeed there were slaves and there were servants. And part of Southern life at the time was to leave your shoes outside of your room. And late at night, your servants would come by and pick up your shoes and go clean them and polish them. Well, many of the guests who came to the president's house at Washington College considered, well, it must be that way here. And going to bed at night would leave their shoes outside the door. And the record is, a servant came by unfailingly and picked up the shoes and took them and washed them, cleaned them and polished them. The servant was General Lee. Humility. The last shall be first. I'd have liked to have talked to you about his concern evangelistically for students. He said to Dr. W.S. White that bringing men to Christ was, and I quote, the leading object that brought me here, speaking of Lexington, unquote. But finally this morning, and I beg for 10 minutes and we're done, I want to give you the factors which influenced the early life and character of Robert E. Lee. I want to identify, with emphasis to mothers and fathers, those factors, and there are five of them, which bore substantial formative influence on the developing manly character of Lee. And they are, in the first place, the example and legacy of his father. the example and legacy of his father with particular reference to his Revolutionary War career. Though General Lee's father died when Lee was but an 11-year-old boy, and notwithstanding the admitted problems his father had in later years, General Lee held his father in due esteem. General Light Horse Harry Lee had been a respected and an effective cavalry general of the American Revolution. He had been governor of Virginia for 8 years and did indeed exemplify many of the virtues that Lee later came to embody. General Lee's pastor said that Lee was blessed by the appropriate counsel from his fully informed father. Fatherly example, fatherly counsel, clearly bore on the developing manhood of General Lee. And such a factor has ample biblical warrant to remind fathers here that your example and your counsel will bear one way or another on the developing character of your sons and your daughters. And time will not permit the citation of a half a dozen texts and proverbs. But let me do this, brethren. Let me refer you to the section in Bishop J.C. Ryle's Duties of Parents on the power of parental example. But one quote from it. He quotes an Archbishop Tillotson who made this remark: to give children good instruction and a bad example is but beckoning to them with the head to show them the way to heaven while we take them by the hand and lead them to hell. And the rest of the quote develops that kind of poignant remark. Secondly, there was the wise guidance of a mother about whom Lee's pastor writes was as judicious as she was devout. It's not the ideal, but in the providence of God, Lee's father having died when he was 11 years old, Lee's father having moved out when he was a few years earlier because of declining health, it is the fact that Lee's mother seemed to exercise the dominant influence upon his life. In particular, she was responsible for the early training he received in the Word of God and for conveying to him the legacy of his departed father and the legacy of George Washington. Further, his incapacitated mother, Anne Hill Carter Lee, was largely responsible for her son's general education. And most of the biographers say, quite possibly, the traits of gentleness, kindness, sympathy with the sufferings of others were largely resultant from the influence of Lee's mother. And again, time does not permit to quote the passages in Proverbs. I'll only quote one. Proverbs 31:1, the words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. As one writes, she planted in him the soil of truth, morality, and religion, so that his boyhood was marked by everything that produces nobility of character in manhood. Another writes, it was from her lips he learned the Bible. From her teaching he drank in the sincere belief in revealed religion which he never lost. It was she who imbued her great son with an ineradicable belief in the efficacy of prayer and in the reality of God's interposition in the everyday affairs of a true believer. Thirdly, as a formative factor on the life of Robert E. Lee, we can identify the duties put upon him as a young man. For most of Robert's youth, his mother was an invalid. Due to the absence and or sickness of other family members, Robert Lee, from very early days, became the housekeeper. He attended to the marketing. He cared for the horses. And he nursed his mother. And at the hour when other boys and girls were out playing, Robert could be seen carrying his mother in his arms to her carriage in order to take her for a ride. A strange providence that at the end of the life of Robert E. Lee, he was doing nearly the same for his wife. His nephew writes, he waited on her, nursed her when sick, drove with her, obeyed her every wish, and the reciprocal love was a goodly picture in old Alexandria to those who saw mother and son in those days. In other words, is it fun? Was not a criteria for Robert E. Lee's youth. He did not worship the god amusement. Take Proverbs and note the repetitious emphasis to a young man about industry in his youth, about diligence in his youth, warnings about laziness. And I bid you, brethren, read the chapter in Sprague's Letters to a Daughter on amusements, the place of fun in a child's life, and the purpose of wholesome amusement in a child's life. And may it wean your parenthood from the criteria, is it fun? Somehow the massive load of duties put upon Lee as a young man did not distort the man's personality. Finally, or fourthly, there was the factor of the pastoral care and the wonderful influence of Bishop Meade of Virginia. And I must pass on beyond my comments there. Fifthly, there was the life of George Washington. In many ways, Lee grew up in the shadow of George Washington. His father served under Washington. His father was a personal and political friend of Washington. Lee was born in the same county as Washington. As a child, worshipped in the same church as Washington. Many of the Washington artifacts were in his home. A large Washington portrait on the wall. His wife was a great-granddaughter of Mrs. George Washington. His father-in-law, the adopted son of George Washington. And from earliest times, Lee had heard of the virtues and the accomplishments of George Washington. He was taught about the man's life. Washington was set before him as one worthy of imitation. Now listen to Jonathan Edwards as he writes in his preface to Brainerd's memoirs about the need to, as I would paraphrase, give your children legitimate heroes. Jonathan Edwards writes this: there are two ways of representing and recommending true religion and virtue to the world. The one by doctrine and precept, the other by instance and example. That was his rationale for the work on Brainerd. Time will not permit for me to follow up with that W.B. Sprague's comments to the same effect in an address that he delivered in Albany, New York in 1847 on the character of George Washington. Now, don't claim by the repetition of George Washington that I believe Washington was a Christian. That's not my place to say one way or another. But Sprague, in that address, made abundantly clear why we must give our children legitimate temporal heroes to teach them true religion and virtue. Stonewall Jackson said, Lee is a phenomenon. He is the only man I would follow blindfolded. Do you know anything about Stonewall Jackson? That's quite a statement. Colonel Chesney, a British military observer, said, in strategy mighty, in battle terrible, in adversity as in prosperity, a hero indeed, with the simple devotion to duty and the rare purity of the ideal Christian knight, Lee joined all the kingly qualities of a leader of men. Jefferson Davis wrote, this good citizen, this gallant soldier, this great general, this true patriot, had yet a higher praise than this or these. He was a true Christian. What is the summary application we must make from a study of the life of Lee or the study of the life of any man of God? Well, the Bible answers. In Hebrews chapter 11, We read of Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, etc. Set before us that we might imitate their faith. But as we turn to Hebrews 12, all of that begins to pale. It's set before us as a model and as incentive, but here's the application. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. Not Lee, not Abel, not Abraham, nor Moses, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. The sense is this. Once you've looked upon a Lee, once you've looked upon a Moses, then the work of the true man of God is to mortify those sins that make you unlike such men, to cultivate those graces that will draw you into a character likeness with them, but preeminently and superlatively, fixing the eyes on Jesus, who is the wherewithal in the soul for the putting to death of the deeds of the body, the laying aside of encumbrances, and the laying aside of sin that entangles and ensnares. Jesus is the wherewithal for persevering in a race of faith. What is the final word from this study? Fix your eyes on Jesus, and in your fixing, put to death the deeds of the body and cultivate the virtues and the graces of which sanctification consists. That's manhood. Act like men. Let's pray. God, may it be that our labors in these hours would cause us to lift our eyes beyond men to the Lord Jesus. Father, may we receive encouragement from men, knowing that the commands of Scripture and the standards of godliness are realistic. But may we fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, for the wherewithal to trod that same way as men of God in other days. Father, may we be a body of men conformed to the blessed image of the Son of Man. Father, aid us in resolution, in endurance, in moral courage, and in perseverance, that we might act like a man. In the name of Jesus, we appeal. Amen.